The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
Hello there and welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of our best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so this week, in 2018, Claire Nelson escaped her busy London life to hike through the Mojave Desert. She talked to me about survival after a 20-foot fall left her alone and fighting for her life. In 1995, Olivia Staunton's younger brother Michael was killed in a hit and run. She spoke to me about her family's continuing search for closure 25 years after Michael's tragic death. And Lorraine O'Donnell talked to me about why she's trying to get more women hooked on fishing. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoy. Bang on 9:30 now, and let's go straight to our first guest, Claire Nelson. Good morning, Claire. Nice to talk to you this morning.
Good morning. Lovely to talk to you too.
You're from what part of the world originally?
New Zealand.
And then London?
And then London, yeah. And so my accent's all over the place.
That's okay. It's not the worst of accents anyways. That's good news story. And a little bit about yourself, if you don't mind, before we head to the Joshua Tree National Park in California. What were you up to and how was life treating you?
I was working for a food magazine in London and feeling a little bit burnt out about life, I guess, and just feeling pretty down. And I was really craving some big nature, some big outdoors.
You see, burnout is a really tough thing in terms of, it's not necessarily a medical, as I understand it, problem, but unless it gets into depression, which is completely different. But sometimes you just get fed up with it all.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, we do get into the habit of trying to put on a brave face, and trying to be like, yeah, I'm fine, everything's great. But really, on the inside, you're just holding it all together.
How are you on social media and so forth? Are you?
Yeah, I was using social media a lot. And I think that's it's a great way to connect with people, but it's also a great way to, again, use it almost like a mask. You can kind of put out there the best bits of your life and hide all the stuff that you're not feeling so great about.
Classic case.
Classic case.
Here's me, filter this, filter that, and not a word of truth in the imparting of that information. So you decided to do something that, having driven around the most beautiful parts of Ireland in the last few days, I found that I constantly looking out going, I would love to spend more time near that lake, on that lake, near that mountain, the great outdoors. Mm. You were drawn to escape.
Exactly. Yeah. And yeah, I would think about like the lakes and the mountains, and I just at nighttime, and I would close my eyes and all the anxieties that would catch up from the day. And I thought, I just want to go and sit by that lake. I want to go and look at that mountain. It's just something was really calling to me.
It's a call, the call of nature in the best way possible. So why the Joshua Tree National Park in California then, 2018?
Yeah, I actually went to Canada, was where I first went, sure. And I was traveling around, but some old friends from London had moved to Joshua Tree, and they invited me down to house sit for them while I were away for 3 weeks. So I thought, well, yeah, I mean, that's big nature right there. That's the desert. So I said yes.
Can you describe the national park to people like me who've never been there or seen it?
It's an incredible place. It's very much, it's not like kind of like a sand desert. It's very rocky. It's, you get these weird cacti and strange plants. And of course the Joshua trees, which are so peculiar looking that you can really feel once you are in the park, another world entirely. It's a mesmerizing place to be.
Sure, sure. We the nearest I had connection I have had is, of course, the U2 album of the same name, and the tree on that would probably give us a picture. What about the animal kingdom? Would that make its presence very much felt in the Joshua Tree Park?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about deserts is that everything kind of hides, but there's so much life there, and so you've got, all kinds of wildlife in them. The more dangerous ones being rattlesnakes, scorpions, coyotes, even mountain lions in some parts of the higher desert.
So all your friends coming out to play. Let's go to then May the 22nd of 2018, and you decided, right, hike day, out we go.
Yeah, I was halfway through my 3 week stay, and pretty much every day was a hike day, but this was a longer hike that I'd planned. So it was an hour and a half drive across the national park, and then the hike itself should have taken about 4 hours in and out. So it was like a big day trip. I was very excited about it.
Were you well prepped?
I thought I was well prepped for a day trip. I had 5 litres of water, although I left a litre behind in the car and I took 4 in with me. Mm-hmm. And I had a hiking stick and I had my sunscreen and my sun hat and it's a bit of food. So I was all set to go.
You sound like somebody who knows what they're doing, so that's a good start. And off you set then onto your walk or your trek. And tell us a little bit about getting to the point where it all went a little askew, to say the least.
I was a couple of miles into the trail, and I knew that there was going to be some scrambling, so clambering over rocks. So the trail at some point came to this big stack of boulders, which are everywhere in this part of the desert, the low desert. And so I didn't think anything of it. I mean, I'm used to climbing over rocks. So up I went. I climbed to the top of this stack of boulders and saw the valley kind of fall away around me. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. But also, gosh, this trail is a little bit difficult. And I didn't realize at that point I'd gone off the trail by about a mile. I'd taken a wrong turn somewhere, which is, it's very easy to do in the desert. It all looks very much the same.
Sure. And but now you're off the beaten track. And what happened?
Well, then I thought, I need to get down the other side of this rock stack. And I was trying to get my footing to kind of climb across it. And I lost my footing. And I started to slip and slide towards the edge. And I fell 25 meters to the ground. And at that point, I had smashed my pelvis, had shattered it. And I couldn't stand up. I couldn't even sit up. The absolute pain of it was the sudden realization that I couldn't move.
Did you hit anything on your way down? I would have thought there were crags or potential pitfalls there too.
Thankfully not. I couldn't see where I was going to land because the rock I fell from was sort of jutting out. It was miraculously, as bad as it was, I landed on a flat piece of area of ground, which was miraculous. It really was. I didn't hit my head or hit my spine.
So that was a miracle, and you land there, and when you tried to move, what could you hear, Claire?
What could I hear?
The damage done to you physically.
Oh well, I mean, when I hit the ground, I heard my bones crack. I heard that sound, and when I tried to move, I could feel the bones in my hip. They were kind of jangling, I could feel them moving. I knew what had happened. If you shatter your pelvis, you know straight away what you've done.
Of course.
Yeah.
Do you have a kind of existential, crisis? Or because you're not in a position to do much about it, what happens in your mind?
Well, I mean, the first thing I thought was, well, this is bad. Okay, I grabbed my phone. I think I'll call 911. And realized, of course, I'm in the middle of the desert. There's no phone signal, not at all. And so that was the moment I thought, this is really bad. I'm in a very serious life or death situation now. And the first thought was obviously to sort of panic momentarily. And then, I just started to think about how am I going to get out of here? Your brain goes into the sort of survival mode of practical information in your brain.
And ever the I suppose the social media fan, you did something that was quite prescient in some ways. Was you started recording messages?
I did, yeah, I know. And it was one of those things. I thought when I realised I might not get out of there, my first thought was, well, I need to let people know. And I'm a writer, so normally I would write things down, but of course I didn't have the tools for that. But I thought I can leave a video message. Just to say what had happened. And then as time went on, I actually started recording more messages. It was more for me, I think, just to stop myself from going a bit balmy, but also just kind of updating whoever might find it as to what had gone on.
What were you saying in the messages?
I was kind of... They varied from me being really mad at myself and to telling the people I love that I love them. And some of the later videos were me kind of describing what was happening to me physically and what I was feeling.
And in terms of you're protecting yourself, the sun was beating down on you, you couldn't move, you've no signal in your phone. It's a desperate situation to be in. How did you physically look after yourself?
Yeah, I mean, the heat is unbearable. It's like if you open the oven door and you get hit with that, you know, and the oven's on it. It's like that, but you can't get out of it. And so the only thing I could do was to cover myself up, which not being able to move was difficult. So, but I had a map, which I spread. I had a hiking stick, because I was wearing shorts, and I had a hiking stick, and I would put sunscreen on the end of it and use that to sort of smear it over my legs, and then create a sunshade with the hiking stick and my T-shirt.
How about at your first night then in the desert? Does your imagination play tricks on you? I mean, were you delirious or were you compos mentis?
Yeah, I was completely aware of what was going on around me, but, you know, fear definitely took over. It was the middle of rattlesnake season, and I was convinced. I mean, snakes don't even come out at night, but in the dark, you know, everything's terrifying, and I was convinced I was seeing snakes moving in the shadows all night. It would, you know, they weren't there. It was my imagination. Yeah. But yeah, the fear was doing funny things to me.
Well, take us then, Claire, to day two. At this stage, you've blisters, you've sores. Mm-hmm. Clearly, you want to roll over, but that wouldn't be a very wise thing to do. How was the water situation at this point?
Yeah, my water, as I say, I had 4 litres, and by the time I fell, I only had 3. I wasn't doing a great job at rationing, but it's very hard in that heat. So I was beginning to run out. And during this during the course of the first 24 hours, I'd been kind of collecting my urine in a bottle just to kind of keep myself clean and kind of prevent the sort of spread of any kind of scent that might attract wild animals. Mm. And so by the time the water was running very dangerously low, I knew I had to contemplate the other bottle of liquid that I had to hand.
The urine,
yeah.
And was that a difficult decision, or was that one that was life or death?
It wasn't difficult. The desperation to keep hydrated, it wasn't, you know, you think this is going to be gross, but you don't get squeamish about it. You just know that all you really want to be able to do is to stop your mouth from drying out and to get something into your body that's going to make you feel hydrated in one way or another.
Because I think I would have been, you know, obviously queasy about that thought once upon a time. And then with the prevalence of survival programs you see on TV, there's nearly always a moment when this happens. So it probably takes the horrible taboo away from it a little bit. Can I ask you why it took 3 days for you to cry?
It's a good question. Yeah. I'm not a crier.
Okay.
I keep all my emotions buried very, very deep, which I think probably contributed to the way I was feeling when I had this burnt out sort of feeling in London, where I, you know, you keep a brave face on all time. And so I've never really been one to kind of cry or wear my emotions on my sleeve. And it's funny to look back and think that even in these most dire of moments, it still wasn't natural for me to just suddenly become someone who was bawling. But by day 3, the fact that I was crying was, that says a lot. Kind of, if you see me get teared up, that's me bawling. I'm sobbing.
I understand. I think people are, I totally understand that. And if your friends were, Claire's crying, this is bad.
Exactly.
Yeah. Some people are criers. You know, the door doesn't go into the key doesn't go into the door or whatever it might be, and they'll bawl out, cry. Whereas, you're in the other end of the market. I understand entirely. What did you fantasize most about in those desperate hours?
It's funny. I obviously water, but my summertime drink is a Diet Coke.
Okay.
A can of Diet Coke.
Could you imagine?
You know, that cracker that's, you open the can and it's kind of got the beads of condensation, and I couldn't stop thinking about
it.
Oh, yeah, I wanted it so bad. It was a painful, you know, craving. It really was.
Of course, it should have been water, but like you say, it's just that little added. hunger must have been awful. Dehydration must have been awful. But let me ask you a little bit about the thoughts of, you know, one's life passing through your eyes, through your mind at least. What did you think about in terms of you and your family, and maybe the possibility that you that it was endgame?
Yeah, I would think, and the only way I could contemplate the fact that I might die was to kind of imagine their response to that. And it broke my heart to think of that, and to also to think that I wouldn't see them again, my friends and my family, and just imagining the, you know, those conversations where you're sitting around and, you know, debating things over the dinner table, or you're with your friends down the pub and you're taking the mickey out of each other. And those were the moments that it was just broke my heart that I wouldn't have those again.
When did it become apparent to those who are close to you, loved ones, found it, that you were gone or missing?
Yeah, it's tricky because I'm very independent and very solitary most of the time. And then when I'm traveling, it's even harder to keep tabs on me. So after about 3 days, I think friends and family, had a few people admitted, yeah, it was strange that you were so quiet on Instagram.
what a sign of our times. Yeah,
I know, it's shameful, but you know, I have to admit it because it saved my life. And even my mum was concerned, and she'd sent me an email saying, you know, look, no. But of course, I didn't reply to that.
You weren't in a position to do that. There's a tiny little dropout, incidentally, in case people are wondering, are their phones or radios broken? It's just a little glitch in the line. But I think we'll continue with pace because we're not missing enough for it to be a problem. let me ask you then, Claire, if I may, about the search and rescue that your friend Natalie, who you were house-sitting for, said, I better just find out where Claire is. you were clearly drifting in and out of consciousness or sleep, at least. When did you hear the buzz of a chopper?
It was in the afternoon, and I thought I'd imagined it. I thought, because I wasn't fully kind of coherent at this point.
And day
I thought,
four.
Oh, no. Day four, yeah, the afternoon of day four. And I think by day four, I'd begun to accept. I'd reached the point of acceptance.
Gosh.
So, you know, when you lose hope, you start to, I think the body sort of follows. And I was very weak. So I heard this sound, and I actually heard a voice first. A voice came out of the sky and sort of jolted me into consciousness again. And it was the announcer from a helicopter.
Just trying to find somebody over here.
That thing shouting at
you,
looking for you.
Yeah, okay. Exactly.
And you thought, great, this could be it. I'm out.
Yeah, yeah. They said they announced they were looking for a missing hiker. And I remember thinking, oh, it could be me. Or maybe it's another hiker. But either way, there's somebody out.
And to get their attention?
To get their attention, the only way I was able to get their attention was to make my flag, my sunshade, into like a big flag, as big as I could. And I was waving it. But it was hard because I had these very high rocks all around me. They'd have to go directly over me to see it.
So you used a white plastic bag for starters.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't, it wasn't effective enough. The helicopter drifts away, but it comes back calling for you. It's gone again. And the third time, Who knew Bob Dylan would be such a part of your story? I mean, what happened?
Well, I had this Bob Dylan T-shirt. So I had the T-shirt, I had the plastic bag, I had my hat. I tried to put everything I could into this flag and hold it as high as I could without dropping it, you know, still just my fingertips and waving it. And everything came together, and they passed over it at just the right point. And the lookout, there was a pilot and the lookout, wonderful man by the name of Manny. He saw a movement, and he said it could have been plastic bag blowing around. They said there's a lot of rubbish in the desert, but something, he said, there was something. He had a feeling. It made him go back, get the binoculars out, just double check. And he said, no, that's the hiker.
Amazing, amazing. So yeah. Eric and Manny are the two people who changed your lives. And if you ever were to have cats or puppies or kittens or even humans, you'd call them after those two people.
I really should.
Okay, talk to me a little bit about then about getting onto that helicopter and that sense of being saved and being alive. I mean, it's a big, big rescue here.
It's a big rescue. And the funny thing is, because I'd accepted I wasn't going to make it, the fact that I suddenly realized I was actually in shock. I couldn't believe that, oh, no, hang on a minute, I am going to live. And I wasn't expecting it. And you know, they had to call in another helicopter to drop in a stretcher to roll me out, and it was excruciating. And they lifted me out and took me to hospital. And suddenly, I realized that everything was different now, that I felt changed, completely changed.
You said when I feel like slipping, I have something to kick my boots against, gratitude.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you just give me a flavor of what that means?
Yeah, I think just it's one of those things where I let fear and anxiety and self-doubt and everything really cripple me before in my life.
Sure.
And now when I feel those things, I have that gratitude. It's kind of like, you know what, even the bad stuff, I'm lucky to feel that. It's part of living, is the bad stuff and the good stuff. you can't kind of selectively live your life and selectively feel things. Yeah. And just being here at all, like talking to you right now, like everything is just, it's a gift.
Well, I suppose that you also have that sense that you wouldn't know what something beautiful was if you haven't experienced something ugly.
This is it. You have to have the dark with the light.
That's for sure. Well, look, I'm delighted that you were rescued and taken up into the skies, into freedom and life. And I hope life is kind to you, Claire. Thank you so much for joining us this morning, telling your story, and congratulations on your book.
Thank you so much.
Nice to talk to you.
You too.
Claire Nelson joining us on the program this morning. The book, and it's got that sense of adventure and odyssey in life. It's called Things I Learned from Falling, and that's by Claire Nelson, our guest this morning. We have lots more coming up for you after this. We're going to talk a little bit about memory and loss and indeed closure with our guest this morning. I'd like you to meet Olivia Staunton. Good morning, Olivia. Nice
How
to talk
you,
to you. Thanks for coming in to see us today. Tell us what part of the country you're from.
I am living in Greignamana now. I'm originally a Kilbride woman, Carlow woman, so...
So proud Carlo woman.
A proud Carlo woman.
And it's Carlo where we're going to go because it's your brother Michael we're going to talk a little
yes.
bit about. And up until the age of 17, what class of fellow was Michael? Because I get the impression there was a lot of fun in that fella.
A lot of fun.
Tell me about him.
He was just magical. He was all fun. His best friend and himself got up to the best of mischief. Fun in the house, fun wherever you go. Yeah, he was special.
He was you'd know he was in the room.
You'd know he's in the room.
More than most.
Yeah.
Full of chat, full of devilment.
A good boy, no harm.
And what year was he in at the age of 17?
He just finished his leaving.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's 24 and a half years ago now. And
yeah.
This is where I suppose our story begins in some ways with an ending.
Yes.
And he had just finished his leaving cert and it was December the 8th.
Correct, yeah.
Where had he been? In the previous hours?
He had been down to his best friend's house, which was a local pub. But he was there every day. They were inseparable, the two of these guys, himself and James Kelly. So he was there and my sister was there. It was morning anyway. It was, you know, early morning. Walked home, but unfortunately he didn't make it all the way. We know that around 5 o'clock we got the call to say that he was in trouble. He was after being killed on the roads.
Okay, well, I'm sorry for starters. I mean, that's a horrible thing to happen to any family.
Yeah.
Horrible thing to happen to any family. And in some ways, the pain was compounded by what happened that night, because if you can put the pieces together for us, what do you know happened to him on the road?
Well, what we do know is that he was struck by something and then he was on the road. And then, unfortunately, a man came coming from work, was going home, and he drove over him again. So he was left on the road and he was drove over again.
So he had been hit by a vehicle of some sort initially.
Yeah.
And then abandoned, as it were, like a hit and run, essentially.
Yes.
And the second person drove over your poor brother.
Correct.
and did what? Then
and
afterwards.
Got out and then ran to a house that was just up the road. And unfortunately for the man in the house, it was Michael's godfather.
Oh God,
so
okay.
When he came out, he went, I know this chap. This is Michael Foley. So that's how Michael was fairly close to home. He just, you know, but for him, it has to have been awful, you know.
And the man who alerted the neighbours to what
yes.
happened to your brother, Was he, I wonder, at any point concerned that people might have thought he was the person who had knocked down your brother in the first instance?
I'm not sure about that, because I do know that the poor man was in an awful state, because he did come to the funeral and we briefly met him, and there was nothing he can do. There was a dip in the road. Michael was lying on the road.
He couldn't have helped anything like that.
Yeah.
When the phone call came through to you then, how did you respond, Olivia?
Well, my boyfriend at the time, which is now my husband, Dennis, he had sent word through my boss. So by the time he'd get to me, I was living in Kilkenny. So by the time he'd get to me, then I would know not to have him arriving on the door. And so anger is just, you know, you're angry, you're sad, you're everything, because this isn't the first time that our family was hit with tragedy. So, it was just awful, awful. And you just want to get that journey back to home. Even though it was only 20-something miles, was just so long.
How old were you at the time?
I was 20.
20 years old.
Yeah.
And it changed your world, I presume.
Changed our worlds, all our worlds completely, yeah. But look, I like my other siblings, I got married, I had kids, I built a house, you know, life moved on. But not for mammy and daddy, you know, life didn't move on. They never forgot.
Did they ever recover?
Honestly, no.
Yeah.
No. They would talk about him all the time. Anybody that was willing to talk about Mary or Michael was just, they would talk about him all the time.
When your brother was killed in that horrible accident, you got home then that day. What sort of sight did you get home to?
Well, I got home to, we have a big yard, as we call it, back in the country. So, and it was full of neighbours, cars, friends. And you walk in the door and you see your mam sitting in a rocking chair. And she's not there. She's there, but she's not there. And then daddy's sitting on a press beside her, trying to comfort her. And then you go and meet the other brothers and sisters and, you know, and that's it. You go through the motions then of, you know, do you bring him home to wake him? Do you not? You know, and we did. We brought him home to wake him. And it was like he was just asleep.
Yeah. I noticed you brought some pictures in with you today.
I did. He wasn't very photogenic now, to be honest. It was very hard to get a good photo of him.
You're being really mean. He's a handsome devil.
He is a handsome devil.
Yeah, so why are you slagging him? Even, you know, once a big sister, always a big sister.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he was.
Why are you slagging him?
Because we always, that was it. Well, I mean, at breakfast table, myself and Michael used to stack the cereal boxes up so we wouldn't be looking at each other across the table. Yeah.
And, you know, look, I'm looking at him. I'm lovely to see you smiling because you're remembering, like, I would have had the same thing with my siblings, the messing at the kitchen table with the cereal boxes and coughing into them so they wouldn't take them, you know, that kind of messing.
Yes.
And look at that young boy, that brother of yours. He looks like he could be the captain of the local team.
Oh, he loves sport.
Did he?
He loves
sport. He has the look about him.
He's played for Kilbride. He just loved football. Yeah, football was his thing.
And where's that picture sit in your house?
Well, that sits on a shelf in my kitchen.
And tell me, Olivia, it's 20, as you say, 24 years since that awful accident. And do you think that, I mean, is it possible for you to feel that you have all the answers you know, or do you still feel you're in a kind of limbo?
I would have liked somebody to have kind of owned up to it. And especially, Mam always said that if somebody just wrote a note, it's not why we're not going to do anything about it. But if just somebody said, look, it was me.
The hit and run person.
She would have probably got more closure on it, you know. Not for any other reason, only just to know.
That's fascinating that she feels that some sort of explanation or somebody owning up would have eased her pain.
Yeah, absolutely. Because they carried it for, you know, for years.
Would it ease yours?
Absolutely. It would be nice that somebody, you know, they're carrying a conscience. Somebody has a conscience, you know. Somebody out there has a conscience that they know what happened that night. And it would be nice to know. Will I ever know? Probably not.
What would it do for you? If you got a note through the door from somebody saying, I was that driver.
I would just say, okay. That's it. Job done. You know, only unfortunate thing is Mam and Dad didn't get to see it. But I would just close the book. Well, I wouldn't close the book because you'd never forget about him. But it was just, you know.
It would offer a full stop of sorts in the sentence.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Which doesn't take away from your ongoing grief, but it just that element of it.
Yes. Just that little bit would just say, OK.
Even if it triggered somebody driving along today who possibly was that driver listening to you this morning and said in a fit of conscience, I'm going to write to that lady.
Yeah, absolutely.
They'd be doing a great service to
great
your family.
A great service, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
With that in mind, tell me about the stretch of road that the accident happened, just in case somebody suddenly finds themselves remembering back to December the 8th in that particular year. Where is the road?
So the road is the main Carlow to Buntlody, Wexford Road.
Yeah.
So between Ballon and Kildavin, there's a stretch of road there and there's a football pitch, Kilbride football pitch, and it's just past that. We live down that road, so Michael was just nearly off the road that night.
God, just that close.
Just that close.
You know, they say you're never home until you're home.
No, you're never home until you're home.
That expression just looms large in the studio this morning. You mentioned a minute ago, Olivia, don't mind me saying so, that you'd already had a previous family tragedy. Could I ask you about that?
Yeah, sure.
What happened?
That was my sister Mary. She was 16 and she went to a hospital. She had kidney problems, so she wanted to get it sorted. So every other time, Mam had went with her, but this time she said, I'm too old for you to be hanging out with me going to hospital. So,
Independence.
Yeah, her independence, yeah. So she went and she was had an allergic reaction to the dye they gave her and she died on the table.
This is the dye for the X-ray?
Yes.
And she reacted to that?
Yes, she had a reaction to that, yes. She never came back in with the ambulance driver. So again, I don't remember much of Mary, but I do remember the time that we found out that two guards came into the yard and they couldn't tell us. They couldn't tell Mammy, so they had to make the phone call.
You never forget the presence of a guard in the house,
no,
do you?
No.
I mean, you never forget the sadness of something that enormous in your life.
Absolutely, yeah. It's amazing. You know, but they have an awful job to do.
You have another picture. I don't know if there's anything left on the walls in your house.
No.
What's this picture of here?
This
there's another
is my
big frame.
And me.
Your mom looks like if you looked up the dictionary under Irish grandmother, you'd see your mom's face. She looks really warm.
Yeah.
And really smiley, rosy cheeked.
Amazing woman.
And kind of a twinkle in the eye.
Yeah. She was good fun. Very simple woman. Doesn't want to go anywhere, just sit at the table and have a chat. And a laugh. And we did laugh a lot amongst all the tears and the grief and everything. But she definitely deserves her rest. She did not have an easy life, though. She deserves her rest.
How old was she last March?
She was 79.
And how did she die?
She had been sick for a little while and then she was, everything just got on top of her and then the heart was slowing down and it was her time.
It's time to say goodbye. Yeah. And it's interesting you should say she deserved her rest.
She does.
You felt that she'd lived as much of life as she could.
Yeah, her job was done. We weren't ready to let her go, but she deserves a rest.
And as I look here at your mother and your very photogenic brother, despite what you say in the other photograph, what keeps you going as somebody? You're a very warm person and you've got a great humour about you. Somebody else mightn't be able to find that humour amid all the grief. How do you keep going?
Yeah, I've two girls that are full of fun. So when I mean girls, they're teenagers.
Yeah.
So they're great. And I have a husband then that keeps me on my toes as well.
Okay. But these are important things that you mentioned, that you can laugh. That despite the darkness, that despite the sadness, that humour and living for today is as important as
absolutely. You have to have a purpose and you have to get up and you have to enjoy what you have. It's very short. Life is very short.
That's for sure. And you know more than most. And Olivia, I'm not mad about the word closure because I think that you'll always have an open book when it comes to your family, your brother and your mother. But I hope you get some class of answer by way of somebody maybe just deciding, OK, I've lived with this all my life and I'd love to change that by maybe writing to you through us or whatever it might be to find that for you. But thank you for coming to see us this morning and telling us your story. It's been really good to talk to you.
Great.
And I know you have two teenage brats outside that want to say hello. So let's say hello to them.
Okay.
And I'm sure they're not brats at all.
They're not. No, they're not.
The big maternal pause.
They're not. They're okay. Actually great.
They're great. Yeah, they keep you happy. Yeah. Olivia Staunton, mind yourself and your family. And thank you for saying hello to us
today. Thank you very much, Ryan.
Not at all. The text number this morning, 51551. One thing you don't see a huge amount of if ever you happen to go fishing by the lakes of the Carve or the Mask or the Moy or wherever you might be is women. For whatever reason, you don't see a lot of it. But they're out there and they want more of you. This is what we're hearing from Lorraine O'Donnell. Good morning, Lorraine.
Good morning, Brian. How are you?
I'm great. What is it you want? It's like, I'm reminded of the Kitchener poster, Your Country Needs You. It's like your lake needs you.
Absolutely. Yes.
Talk to me.
Okay, so... Yeah, women don't really fish. And as you say, we don't see a lot of them fishing. And we set about, we've done a number of programs over the years and invited women along. And they generally didn't show up, basically.
Yep.
So we decided then we'd go and do a little bit more detail. And we talked to a few people and a few experts. And we put a package together and we tried to make it as attractive as possible for women to at least try fishing. So we're saying you can come and try it. all you do is book in and show up, and we're going to run you through what you could need to do or what it's like. And then hopefully we'll get a number of them then that would like to go fishing, and we might link them in with a group or develop a program around getting them to go fishing. And it's been amazing so far. It's been a roller coaster for the last 2 weeks. It's been phenomenal, the interest from women. It's actually bowled me over, to be honest.
And what are they saying? Why are they coming out, and what are they getting from it?
Yeah, so what they're saying is that obviously the reason that the barriers they were saying why they didn't go fishing was that it's perceived as being male orientated.
Yep.
And it's a cold, damp, wet sport where it can be quite boring. And to be honest, you know, that's probably a perception not just women have, a lot of people have.
Yes.
So then what we said, so we said that, okay, we'll cover the aspect of the equipment and all that. So all the equipment is going to be provided for them. So that ticked that
box. That's a huge box to tick, by
huge
the way, because you've got the line, the rod, the flies, the cast. You've got the, you want to have maybe coats and hats if it's hot. And, you know, you need to be well prepped.
Yeah. And anyone who likes the outdoors knows that once you're well prepped,
yeah,
you don't really notice whether the weather is good or bad,
definitely.
So we have that covered. So then the locations then was the next one. And these aren't in order, actually. I'm going to give you the last one first.
Okay.
The first and last. The next one then was the location. So it's funny how we pitched it as in locations. So we went where we've got experts kind of to help us anyway. So obviously Ballina. And note, we didn't say the Moy in Ballina, because if we said the Moy in Ballina, it doesn't mean a lot to non-anglers, really.
Yeah.
Whereas Ballina is like, oh, yeah, it's nice. I go there on my holidays and whatever. And it's the same. We said Cork for the River Blackwater and Limerick for the River Shannon. So three beautiful. I mean, I know yourself, you're an angler, Ryan.
I'm only a spoofer, rivers. But I don't have the time to do it. But I could wax lyrical about it. In terms, I wouldn't call it a sport. I'd call it a joy, a symphony for the soul. It's such a beautiful thing to do. Nature, birds, water lapping, the boat, the removal from reality, and it's just a gorgeous thing for the head. And I've never fished the Blackwater, but every time I've been to, say, Lismore Castle or see the Blackwater in full flow, it's just beautiful. Flowing water, water generally, is just beautiful in its natural.
Beautiful. Yeah. Absolutely. And the sky changes and the water changes. Everything changes while you're there.
Yeah.
And so we've gone for beautiful locations. I mean, it's really like, you know, tourism as well, kind of attractive to get the women to get into interest in that side. And then the other side, then we went for like the top woman in Ireland. I mean, even the men say she's one of the top in Ireland. I mean, they're jealous. And it's really funny, some of the comments. And as talking to families at events, and the men are kind of saying, well, you don't want to be talking to her too much now, because, you know, I go fishing to get away from things. I don't want to be really wife with me.
Yeah. Well,
so
you know what?
You can go
on that boat and I can go on that boat and we can meet up in about an hour or two, you know, or maybe three or four. Where are you from originally?
Okay, I'm from Kinvara. Everybody I know is from Kinvara.
We need to go to Kinvara. I've got it into my head. I want to go and do a show from Kinvara because it's such a beautiful.
We've
passed through it, but we haven't stayed. Now, do you come from a fishing family, or are you a newbie, or how does this work?
Oh, I don't come from a fishing family. We're the families that live along the coast that mackerel fishing in the summer.
Lovely.
My dad, Tommy McCormick in Kinvara,
he
is stone mad about mackerel fishing. He feeds half the village, you know, and when they're in, and it's so much fun. And, you know, my kids do it as well, a small bit with him. And I do that myself. To be honest, I'm one of the people that kind of think angling is boring. And I've come around slowly by, you know, following people and going with people and meeting. And I have to say, meeting women, we met two amazing women down in Limerick last summer in one of the small events we ran. And, you know, it is a joy. It's absolutely so peaceful. It's so beautiful. I can't say enough about it.
No, I agree. Yeah. Sorry, just as you're talking about your dad even chatting earlier on about Ned and Eamon and father and son, in your case, father and daughter. It's a beautiful thing. I remember with my own girls, pulling mackerel out of the sea a few times, and even with their friends or what have you, there's something so much fun, and it's Mother Nature in action, and Darwin in action. But
and when the fish goes on the hook and you've got something on the end of the line.
It's the thrill of the line, yeah.
It's just a bunch of blasts of adrenaline.
That's right.
And the excitement and the shrieks and the shrieks.
Yes,
and,
yes.
You know, and like that, then what you do now kind of thing. You know what I mean? That's what you see.
I thought you could only buy them in the shop would be a common reaction from a city child. But nevertheless, but then the fly fish is a completely different experience, as you know, and it's a much more calm. It's not definitely not for kids, because it's if you're like me, you'll either never catch one or you might catch one in a blue moon. But it's just about being out there. That's the joy, as much as anything else.
And there is a lot of concentration in it. I know as a beginner on the fly fishing, because I'm counting in my head, 10 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 1, 2, 3, fling, and this is what the girls are teaching us. And there is a lot of concentration, and it is really nice for your brain. I think it does develop, you know, that whole thing we're saying about using our brains more and dementia and all that. I think there's a lot of that in it that people don't even realise, you know.
Well, Donald in Dublin says, my father once told me, fishing has nothing to do with catching fish. What a nice way of putting it.
It's lovely,
makes total sense, as he says. And Sean was on, you know, again, it's lovely memories. My sister Catherine, God rest her, was a great fisherwoman and caught many trout and an odd salmon on Loch Mask. So he's remembering life there. And the Tiernan brothers in Foxford and Mayo run an angling business in Foxford on the River Moy. We'd be more than happy to see more people, young and old, getting into the sport. So thanks for giving it the promotion. Well, it's a lot of it's tied up. We used to fish a little in my own family down in Connemara and Ballinahound there near Inverin in Connemara, and I've the happiest memories on that lake again with my dad, and he'd be smoking a Silcut Purple and we'd have the fig rolls and a pot of coffee, never tea, but lovely memories. I'm there on the lake as a boy as we speak. Another says fly fishing clubs here and in the UK are crying out for younger members because fly fishing is dying, they say there, and the youth find it too slow and not instant enough and too boring. But you're talking about women rather than younger people, or you can combine both, obviously. And you're encouraging people to log on to fisheriesireland.ie/women, and they can find the dates and locations and head out for an afternoon of pure delight and introduction to that world. Is that it, Lorraine?
That's it. There's just another event that's coming up as well in Mayo, the Casting for Recovery, and that's a really... really amazing initiative that started in the US, and there is an event in Ireland this year, and they have events between Ireland and the UK. They have a Facebook page, and they are for women that are going through breast cancer and surviving breast cancer, because they find the action of fishing actually, as well as the mental well-being, it actually physically helps their muscles.
Tremendous.
And it's been proven so, and that's on in Mayo as well this summer in April.
What a great thing to
so
do.
So definitely people, you know, they might take a different cohort of people that might like to go to that, and they have a lot of social events around that as well.
Sounds
you know,
good.
Gathering. So it's really nice. Yeah.
Sounds good. Lorraine, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. We'll see you somewhere. Tight lines, as I say.
Thank you, Ryan.
All the best. Lorraine O'Donnell joining us from, she's Education and Outreach Officer with Inland Fisheries Ireland, and fisheriesireland.ie/women for more details on that.